This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Perhaps the biggest recent development in the cyber world is the phenomenal growth of the World Wide Web. My guest is the creator of the web, Tim Berners-Lee. The web is a global library of text, pictures, audio, and video that exists on the international computer network known as the Internet. Berners-Lee made it possible for us to get at this information without having to learn complicated computer languages. He also devised a system for linking related documents. He made the web so easy to access that everyone and everything seems to have a website now. Berners-Lee created the web prototype in 1989 while at a physics lab in Geneva, Switzerland. In 1994, he left to launch the World Wide Web Consortium at the MIT Laboratory for Computer Science, which creates standards and new software for the web. I asked Tim Berners-Lee what the web enables users to do that they couldn't do before.
Well, for many years before the web existed, there was a network of computers. And the network consists of cables and computers and things called routers, which connect the cables together. And to use it, you have to get onto a computer and learn a program to talk to the network and maybe use that program to talk to another computer. And when you've got talking to that other computer, you have to learn to use the program which is on that other computer. That was the situation. So that in order to use the ability of the network to move information from one place to another, you had to know all about it. What the web enables you to do is to see the information, which in fact is stored on computers, which are connected through the network, without being aware of how they're connected and which particular computers are involved. It just allows you to explore the information in an information space. The web is the universal space of information.
And you don't need to learn a specialized computer language to access it.
That's the whole idea, yes.
Now, what were your frustrations with the Internet before you created the World Wide Web?
I wouldn't say that I was particularly frustrated with the Internet. The Internet was a great thing. I found that the computing environment in general wasn't largely on the Internet. And also, of course, there's a terrible incompatibility that almost everything which you needed to know in your daily life was written down somewhere. And at the time, in the 1980s, it was almost certainly written down on a computer somewhere. Somebody had typed it in. They typed it into some computer somewhere. It may not have been connected, but even if it was connected, it was probably a different sort of computer. And to actually get that information onto your computer would take a lot of knowledge. It would probably involve going up the corridor to talk to a guru to ask him how to go connect to the network. And then when you connect it to the network, ask another guru how to talk to the other computer, and then maybe when you got talking to it, you'd probably have to type help a lot of times to get the information. And probably when you got it would be incompatible form and you wouldn't be able to display it on your own screen. So the whole thing was, it was a mess, and it was very frustrating that people's effort in typing it in was not being used. The information was not being used, when in fact, if it could only be tied together and made accessible, everything would be so much easier for everybody.
Now, did you set out trying to make accessible all the information on the Internet, or was your initial goal more modest than that?
Well, the initial goal wasn't to set out and make all the information available, but it was to create a space in which any information could be available, which is almost the same thing, but not quite. Clearly, any system which started off and only ran on one computer wasn't going to work. And any system which started off but would work with 100 documents or 1,000 documents but wouldn't be able to hold 100,000 documents wasn't going to work. I wanted a system which would work if I started using it in my group and somebody else started using it in another group on the other side of the planet, and we suddenly realized that we had some information that was related, that would allow us to, just by making a very simple link, connect those two together into one large information space without having to do something like take a tape with all the information from one system and cart it across to another computer and to load it in and convert the format and merge the two databases.
Now, at the time you created the web, you were working at a European particle physics lab, yes?
Yes. Now, CERN, as it's known.
What was the prototype of the web that you created? What was the first thing resembling what has since become known as the web?
Well, the first thing which had web-like properties was a program I wrote called Enquire, which was short for Enquire Within Upon Everything, which was the title of a Victorian book which I'd seen, which reckoned to have everything about the Victorian household in it. And Enquire was like many computer programs into which you type information, apart from the fact that you could make random links from any piece of information to any other piece of information. So it didn't have hypertext at the time. It had a list of links at the bottom of each note. But you could make a note from any note to any note. There was no structure forced on you by the program. And I found that was very powerful. That was 1980. And then 1989, I wrote the prototype World Wide Web program, which was a GUI hypertext editor. You could write very much as into a word processor. You could type text, and you could make headings, and you could make links just as you might make headings by using hotkeys or using the mouse and menus.
I should ask you to explain what hypertext is.
Hypertext is just like text, apart from the fact that when you see a reference to something else, as you see always when you're reading the newspaper, for example, it says that continued on page 34 or see leader on page 18. When you read it on a computer screen where it says see the leader on page 18, you can, it's in blue or it's underlined or it's in a little box. You can click on it with the mouse. You move the mouse over it, you press the button, and behind the text, invisibly known to the computer but not to you, is the address of the thing it's referring to in a way that stored in a form that the computer can use to go and get it. So that may be just page 18 of the same newspaper, or it may be page 18 in somebody else's newspaper on the other side of the world. Whatever it is, you click on it, the computer goes and gets it and displays it on your screen. Sometimes it puts it up in place of what you were reading, or sometimes it opens a new window on your screen and puts it next to it so that you can see the two things together. Hypertext is the ability to take a link from anywhere to anywhere. When you read hypertext, it's a lot faster if you want to get at something. If you're reading an article which isn't really what you wanted to know, but it refers to something that is what you wanted to read about, then you can jump to that. You can jump and jump and jump to things more and more relevant until you find exactly what you want. So it's exciting from the reader's point of view. From the writer's point of view, when you're writing hypertext, you don't have to keep including information from other places. You can just put a link to it. If you want to refer to something you've written before, you want to refer to something which is out there, which somebody else has written, by putting a link, it enables people who don't know about it to go and find it. For example, if this was a hypertext talk, we could have just put a link on hypertext, and somebody clicking on that, reading the transcript, would be able to jump off, read all about hypertext without us having to take the time out to explain it. We would have been able to keep on with the main thread.
Right. My guest is Tim Berners-Lee. He created the World Wide Web and now directs the Web's consortium at MIT. So you spent several years with this program that you called Inquirer, using a World Wide Web type structure just for your own personal use. And then 8 years later or so, you started expanding it. What was the first step to letting other people know that you had actually hit upon something that could have an extraordinary international impact?
Well, I didn't exactly go around saying I've hit upon something which has had which could have an extraordinary international impact. The first step was to try to persuade the people at CERN that this would be a good thing to work on.
At the physics lab where you were working.
That's right. And I found that, in fact, quite difficult because a physics lab is a physics lab and you are supposed to do physics there rather than make global hypertext systems. But in 1989, my boss at the time, Mike Sendel, and in fact, in 1990, I originally proposed it in 1989. In 1990, my boss at the time said, why not go ahead, try making a prototype? And so I did that in November of 1990. And then after Christmas, I showed the program to a few people around the lab and started using it myself and started using it with my colleague, Robert Caillou, who's an enthusiast. And then in the summer, I put it onto a file transfer protocol, an FTP server, on the internet, and mentioned it in a news group so that people across the internet could pick it up. And that spread through people who were using the Next machine, which was the machine I developed it on, a Next Step machine, and it spread through people who were interested in hypertext. So through those two communities and through the high energy physics community, it started to spread.
So basically, you put the software for free on the internet. You allowed people to take the software for free.
Yes, initially it was put out for free as experimental and interesting code for people to comment on. And then later on, when people started to use it very seriously, the question came up as to what the policy would be. And I spent 18 months persuading the CERN directorate that it ought to be made available generally for free and that it would help the world if CERN did not demand a license fee for its use.
That means that you did not make money off of the web, right?
I personally didn't make money off the web, no, and CERN didn't ask license fees for it.
You probably could have become a multi-gazillionaire, don't you think?
Well, I don't know. It's difficult to ask what would have happened if, isn't it? At the time, there was, and there still is, a system called Gopher, which came out of the University of Minnesota. And at one point, the University of Minnesota decided that they'd reserve the right to demand license fees. And a lot of people suddenly dropped it and they felt, oh no, here we are jumping on a bandwagon. And in a little while, suddenly we'll be paying for it because somebody will then start tightening the stranglehold and we'll be paying. So with the web setting out as something which was universal, something which anybody could use, I felt was very important. Because it's no good having something which will run on any platform if, in fact, there is a proprietary hold on it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tim Berners-Lee, and he's the founder of the World Wide Web. He also directs the World Wide Web Consortium, which is based at MIT. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Tim Berners-Lee, and he's the founder of the World Wide Web. I'm wondering what you envisioned when you created the web, and if you would compare that to what the web has become.
Well, I think from the diversity of information you find on the web when it comes to subject matter, I'm very happy with the way it's turned out, and that's very much what I like to see. I envisaged a universal space of information in which you could put anything, whether it is a picture of a beautiful medieval manuscript or whether it is something which you just scribble down and really must tell your friends before you forget it. I feel that information of all these types, the scribbled note, the academic paper, the advertisement, even junk mail, there's all sorts of information in the world, there's all sorts of information on paper, all that sort of information should be possible on the web. And we're seeing quite a diversity in terms of subject matter. There's all sorts of weird things. What we're not seeing is the rather hasty information, the informal information. We're not seeing people use it so much in groups on the small scale to organize their thoughts. So what I'd like to have seen more would be groups of people, small groups, who share an understanding, building on that understanding and developing it, for example, in trying to solve a problem by writing together a piece of hypertext which describes the problem, describes their solution, and by writing it together and taking turns editing pieces of it and making the links, building a common knowledge, a representation of that common knowledge. I thought that was a very exciting idea. I think we'll see a lot more of that in the future.
So the web has become more of a library, an information storage system. You wanted the software you created to also be used for a process that would help people solve problems.
More interactively. Mm-hmm. I'd say, mm-hmm. Allowing people to write and to make their own connections. That's the nice thing to do. Is as you're browsing through something which you're discussing with a friend, for example, and you realize that something that you saw the other day is relevant to this and could be answer to the problem. Say you click off, you go back to your homepage, and then you follow the links which take you to where you were. You press a button on your computer, you come back to the thing you're writing and say, and you write, "Hey, Jill, think about this." And you make a link, and then when she reads it, then she follows the link and ends up seeing just what you saw. And now you've connected together two pieces of knowledge. Rather, as in the brain, your mind builds connections between one thing and another. After a little while, something sort of clicks. You can put that click into the system, and other people can follow it.
Do you see any new creations that are just coming on the market or that are on the horizon that you think will change the web even further?
The web is certainly going to change. One of the things that we try to do at the consortium where we define the way computers talk to each other is to define it in the way that they will be able to start off talking one way, and then both computers will be able to adapt and talk in smarter ways and do smarter things as technology evolves. So we hope that we're not tying everybody down to a web which looks always as the web does today. Ooh. There are some exciting things. There's the three-dimensional representation, for example, which tends to need more power in your computer than two-dimensional representation. But as computers become more powerful, then that will become more commonplace. And maybe the computers themselves, instead of having a sort of flat desktop on your screen, it'll become a two-dimensional desktop with shelves you can put things on, and maybe people will find that easier to navigate in using a three-dimensional metaphor.
Explain more what you mean by three-dimensional. I'm a little confused.
Well, The screen is flat, mm-hmm. and most of the things you move around a computer screen are flat icons, and they look like flat sheets of paper, so the thing looks like a desktop seen from above. Mm-hmm. But there are some areas where even though the screen is flat, you get a three-dimensional picture, and using a joystick, for example, you can fly through it. So instead of giving somebody just a picture, a map of the university, a picture of the university appears on the screen, and you can move into it and fly through it and find different departments. So it's very fancy when as virtual reality it makes new science fiction worlds, but also it's very good for teaching, and also because our minds are good at remembering where we put things in three-dimensional space, perhaps it's a good way of organizing information. Perhaps we'll have a three-dimensional virtual house in which we put in which we can put little three-dimensional icons for things we found, and we'll find it easier to remember where things were.
What else do you see on the horizon for the web?
Well, there are a lot of very exciting things happening. One of them is the ability of a document to be active. We call it to be something which in fact is a little program. When you load a document from another computer, you follow a link, your browser software goes off, asks the other computer for a document, and it brings it back very much like a word processor file, and it puts it up on the screen. There's a possibility, however, for some of that file to actually be a little program which can then start running. So if you move over something like, for example, if you're teaching somebody about a physics experiment, you can move over a picture of the apparatus, which when you click on it, it actually starts to do things and bubble and click and whir, and you can watch what happens. Or it can be a simulation. It can be it can load down something which will produce you some video, some animation, something you can interact with. And that is potentially extremely interesting. It could turn into a very exciting world. You can imagine, for example, downloading going into a store and finding a shopping basket there, and then moving that little shopping basket and taking it around with you. And the shopping basket is there on the screen, and every time you drop something into it, effectively you're setting up to buy it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tim Berners-Lee, and he's the creator of the World Wide Web, the founder of it, and he also directs the World Wide Web Consortium at MIT. Now, we've already established that you did not like what copyright the web. Was that a possibility, copywriting it?
I don't think copyright would have been appropriate. Maybe there would have been patents one could have taken out
On the software that you created, on the program that you created.
It would have been possible. There was a point after a couple of years that a lot of people were starting to use the web not just for fun, not just in universities, but also companies were realizing that this was going to be an important part of how their organization worked, sometimes an important part of how their organization interacted with the outside world. There was, at one point, a computer company. Four people from that company came to my office unannounced, knocked on the door, came in, sat around the table, banged on the table and said, "Look, do you realize what resources we're putting into the web? What's going to happen to it? How do we know that it's going to be stable? How do we know that it's going to continue in the future as a basis for all our developments and all the commerce we're going to be doing?" And I asked them what sort of thing they saw as a suitable way of taking the web forward, and I talked to a lot of people about it. I went on a trip around the States as well, asking universities, companies, other organizations, what they felt was a reasonable thing to do, and looking at a suitable place to base a new organization, and decided. And obviously, at that point, I wondered about starting a small company or joining a large company for that matter. And the conclusion was that if the web was run by one proprietary interest, then there would be people who would never want to play. They would always want to start their own one in competition, because they would never want to want to be controlled by one proprietary group. So looking around, I needed somewhere which would be clearly vendor neutral, which would be a neutral place, a forum where all the interested parties could gather. And the computer science lab at MIT came out with checks in all the boxes there. They had already done that for the X Consortium. They set up a vendor neutral platform, and they had also got a good reputation for keeping programs, specifications which they developed available for the whole public. Anything from the X Consortium, the whole public, anybody in the public could get at turned into a product, used for private use, no matter what, it was available, it was free for use, and that is how the standard became adopted. That is a very strong force to get everybody to work the same way. So I talked to the computer science lab people, Professor Michael de Tuzos was very keen about this. He was also very keen about setting up something in Europe as well, setting up an international body, which I, as a European, was interested in. We're both Europeans. And Albert Weser at the lab, who had helped organize the business model for various consortia in the past, also said he was happy to do that for the World Wide Web Consortium. And when you put that with the number of people there doing exciting research around the World Wide Web, and people who had, such as Dave Clark, who was at the lab, who was involved with the defining the TCP protocol. He's basically Mr. TCP/IP many days back in the dawn of the internet. It was clearly a great place to be based. So about 18 months ago, in September 1994, then we set that up. I came over, we set up a consortium, and people, companies of various sorts have been joining ever since. We now have getting on for 120, probably more.
Tim Berners-Lee created the World Wide Web. He now directs the World Wide Web Consortium at the MIT Laboratory for Computer Science. He'll be back in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with the creator of the World Wide Web, Tim Berners-Lee. The web is a library of text, pictures, audio, and video that exists on the global network of computers known as the Internet. Berners-Lee now directs the World Wide Web Consortium at the MIT Laboratory for Computer Science, which is creating standards for the web. I asked him to describe a typical problem the consortium is currently grappling with.
Imagine that there is a company which makes a browser software, which you run on your machine, and server software, and they thought of a nice smart thing they can do, such as moving from pages which you click on to be able to give you a complete presentation of a sequence of pages, for example. They decided that they want to move to putting video in instead of still images. Whatever it is, there's some fancy new thing. The first thing they do is they put it into their product and advertise that their product is the smartest on the market. And then very quickly, of course, all the other products adopt the same feature. But they adopt it in a slightly different way, so that if you try to use the new feature from one person's browser to read information from another person's server, you get a mismatch. You get pages which you might have seen if you've been browsing the web, which say, really, this page is best seen using this particular sort of software. And that means that the World Wide Web, when that happens, is becoming less worldwide. It's starting to become a proprietary area. It's starting to become the case that if you give somebody a point of some information, you don't know whether they'll be able to follow it. So what
they'd
happens
have to buy then, access to it.
They'd have to, well,
They'd have to buy the software to get access.
They'd have to buy different software. Now, it's crazy to have. Can you imagine having, instead of one World Wide Web browser, having 12 World Wide Web browsers?
Right. Now, can you prevent that from happening? How can you prevent that from happening?
We can prevent that from happening by then going to the companies and saying, look, now you don't have a competitive advantage by having something which is, now that everybody has this, let's decide on a way that we'll do it all together. So that we can build on this, so that instead of fighting about exactly how we'll do it and having these incompatibilities which reduce the power of the whole system, let's decide that this is a done deal now. We know that we can do this. Let's do it in a standard way, and let's release that as a public specification so that anybody could do it that way. And then let's go on and invent the next thing. Let's go on and look at all the exciting things we can do using that new feature.
That sounds great, but the profit motive is really strong. What authority do you have to tell a company that, you should really do something universal?
We have no authority at all. However, this is a win-win situation that we have to rely on the fact that being incompatible is no fun for any company. It's a very bad mark to be incompatible with the standards. It's a very bad mark to have people to say, please don't use this particular browser on this page because it really won't work properly. So in fact, what happens is that when the moment it's not it's not really, really the leading edge of what they feel is their most exciting feature for the next version, companies are quite happy to sit around the table, and there are a number of draft specifications which we've released recently which illustrate that.
So the World Wide Web Consortium has basically the power of persuasion? is that the power that you have to regulate the web?
That's right. We're funded by our members, by those companies that we're trying to persuade, so we feel that if they didn't want us to persuade them, they wouldn't have started the consortium in the first place.
So you feel that everybody has a vested financial interest in keeping the web open, and that's one of the things that's going to allow the web to stay open?
Yes, in the end, because the web itself is not, in fact, it's not the end of all things. The web is a means. The web is an exciting information space. We're developing it to make it richer. But what's interesting is what you do with it. What mm-hmm. is interesting are the programs that you have on the clever clients, the clever servers, the totally new applications, when you start doing financial transactions across the internet, when you start seeing three-dimensional things, when you have beautiful educational worlds, that all the applications that you produce on top of that will be enabled by the richness of the web and by the way it interoperates. If a company tries to go out by itself and be separate and be individual and not interoperate with the rest of the world, then unless they can corner the entire market and persuade everybody who's buying software and buying information that that's a good idea, then they'll look very silly if, in fact, the rest of the world gets together and decides to do it in a common way.
As we've said before, you decided not to patent the programs or the software that you came up with to create the World Wide Web. But now that the World Wide Web exists, everybody's trying to make money from it. And you know, more and more people are entering the web in the hopes that if not now, tomorrow, they'll be able to make a buck. What do you think of the growing commercialization within the web?
What do you mean by that? Do you mean advertising sites?
Exactly. More and more advertising sites, more and more people trying to use the web to sell things. But I think in a way, lots and lots of advertising. There's more and more homepages that have sponsors. There's online magazines that have more advertisers on them. Plus, there's a lot of websites that really are no more than public relations vehicles for the company that opened the web page.
Right. Well, let's go back to a couple of things, important points about the web. One is it's universal. So we expect to see all kinds of stuff out there. And I wouldn't want to limit it, just as you wouldn't want to limit paper. Imagine you'd invented paper. Would you say this is great for printing on, you can print on it, you can write on it, but you can't advertise on it? Then there would just be, you'd be trying to tweak society by changing the medium. The medium has to be neutral. Medium has to be universal. So there's a lot of advertising out there. The second interesting thing about the web is that unlike electronic mail or junk mail, any kind of mail, it doesn't jump out at you. You only get information which you've asked for by following a link. So that if you have found a lot of sites with advertising on and you didn't like it, then you don't have to go back there again. You don't have to tell people about it when you write articles. You don't have to put hypertext links to them. You may feel that it's, in fact, you prefer to put pointers to information which doesn't have advertising on it. You can do that. It's a free world. Your readership will choose. People may decide that, in fact, your article isn't interesting because you're not pointing to the interesting things. The interesting things do, in fact, happen to have advertising on it, but they'll take it. And in fact, of course, advertising on the web compared with advertising on television is much less painful in that the only thing you have to see is a little banner with the name of the product. And if you want the details, then you can click on it. So you're already selecting, and the people who are interested in the advertisement are the people who see the hard sell. All the other people have to see is the little icon, the little banner. So in fact, I find that it's quite a nice compromise.
Tim Berners-Lee created the World Wide Web and now directs the World Wide Web Consortium at the MIT Laboratory for Computer Science. This is Fresh Air.